Let's welcome our political commentators today. It is Sue Moroney and Ben Thomas. Kia ora korua. Welcome to Nine to Noon.
Morena, Catherine.
Let's introduce you both. Sue is a former MP with the Labour Party. She's now Chief Executive of Community Law Aotearoa, Law Centres Aotearoa. Ben Thomas is a former National Government Press Secretary, a columnist and a director of the public affairs firm Capital. I want to get each of your takes shortly on the start the government's made, some of what's come out over the first 100 days and how you think things are shaping up. But what is happening at the start of this week is an increasing focus on the government's fiscal track. And I think it's the Deputy Prime Minister, Winston Peters, himself, referring to a fiscal hole of the scale of $5.6 billion. Of course, looking at what happens between the gap between expected tax revenue and commitments that the government has made. Just reading an RNZ story that quotes the New Zealand First leader saying he won't be compromising on the rollout of his election commitments, despite his warning that the government's short of billions of dollars. We'll talk more about his State of the Nation speech shortly. This morning on Morning Report, Nicola Willis, the finance spokesman, doesn't agree with that $5.6 billion figure, but also wouldn't guarantee tax cuts would arrive in July. She said she wouldn't do this until the policy had been discussed by Cabinet. So, interesting to see whether the final crossing of T's and dotting of I's on that budget could lead to some changes in the government's plans. Ben Thomas, what's your take on how things are shaping up fiscally?
Well, I think there was a bit of discussion this morning between Nicola Willis and it was Corinne Dan about the kind of promises that the fiscal plan, in particular the tax plan, were rock solid during the campaign for National. And I think, you know, to use a maybe tortured metaphor, you know, an archway is the most sort of rock solid architectural construction you can have, but it really relies on every piece being exactly the right shape that you contemplated in the design, because otherwise it doesn't work at all. And that's what we're sort of seeing here, is that and this is similar to the previous government in its last budget, that the projections in terms of spending, and which you would sort of include tax cuts in there, were extremely finely balanced against, you know, the revenue projections, with no real leeway if those were to deteriorate, even though we all knew that we were sort of, you know, kind of on the brink of worse economic conditions. So they didn't leave themselves a lot of margin for error. A lot of commentators said that at the time.
Yes, they did.
It's panning out, you know, it's panning out to be, you know, if you're looking at the blueprint in front of you and the plans and the spreadsheets, you'd say, well, this is an unexpected fiscal hole, or this is an unexpected deterioration of the books. If you were looking at the wider picture, you would say, this is probably what we could kind of assume there was at least even odds on happening. And added into that, of course, is the complication of a coalition government where, you know, the parties don't just bring in their initial plans and their promises. They have to accommodate each other. We are in a situation, the first genuine three-party coalition ever, where the two minor parties despite what was said, some pretty hard-nosed negotiating and extracted some pretty big promises. And, you know, that was always going to be a very hard circle to square.
All right. Look, we have to point out there was the foreign buyers tax, which went as part of the coalition agreements because foreign buyers weren't going to be allowed back into the market. New Zealand First insisted on that. The tax on gambling, the latest reports Treasury are indicating that was massively over-optimistic, as people pointed out things were that it possibly was at the time. Having made all these commitments, Sue, where do you see the government at in trying to put a budget together?
Well, look, feigning shock and surprise that things aren't as they thought they might be just doesn't really cut it when, you know, these days we actually have the pre-election economic and fiscal updates, and they got that in September 2023. The National Party made a big deal about waiting to see those figures before it firmed up its policy platform and its promises for the election, and went ahead and did that anyway. So there was a lot of debate at that time where many people were pointing out that it just didn't all add up. And they went into the election with promises that didn't all add up, and then, as Ben quite rightly pointed out, had to then deal with forming a coalition where, again, they've made some commitments to things that just don't all fit. So they've got themselves in the situation and, you know, as I said, feigning shock and surprise that this is not how they thought it would be, it just isn't really good enough and it doesn't stand up, actually.
Mr. Peters telling Morning Report he'd been pointing out for a year the country had a large fiscal hole, so it was no surprise to him to have it confirmed. The economy, I'm quoting, is in far worse shape than people were prepared to concede, was in far worse shape. Sadly, that was the election outcome and our job is to turn it around. The country could still afford tax cuts, he says. Ben, what is it going to mean? We're about to find out the GDP figures on Wednesday. The point is, whatever the nominal headline about technically being in recession or not, there's no question that per capita GDP is well and truly in recession. Of course, we had 140,000 people arrive in the past year as well to pump up that headline figure. But, you know, are there going to have to be some delays to some of what is proposed? Are there going to have to be some concessions by some members of this coalition government?
You've already seen delays being flagged in terms of a number of promises. Already, ACT have agreed to compromise on the, you know, pretty startling concession that they got in their coalition agreement that the, you know, landlord, the mortgage interest deductions would be refunded for this current fiscal year. So that was agreed in negotiations in October, and that's already off, you know, presumably in exchange for something else, which we'll discover in May. You know, everything is up in the air at the moment. I think, you know, it doesn't take a sort of great insider to work out that Nationals' priority, you know, for the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister is delivering tax cuts in a form where they can argue that they are self-funding, at least within the sort of internal logic of the government books, i.e. Saving some money here, stopping some spending here, raising some more revenue here, and that adds up to the quantum of the tax cuts. You know, when you're still pretty heavily in deficit, I'm not sure that you can make the argument that you're not borrowing for tax cuts, but, you know, they will say, you know, in the internally consistent logic of the budget, that's sort of ring-fenced. But look, yes, no, I think you'll see delays on a lot of things, and it could still be, including that tax relief package. You know, the sort of infamous promise to resign was not tagged to, you know, the full package being delivered in the first year. And so, look, they've got room to move there.
Yeah, and so just quoting the Finance Minister this morning, again, it's always a tricky thing to pin a politician down. A semantic debate tends to unfold. She says she can't confirm the government will be able to deliver tax cuts in July as outlined in the coalition agreement. She said they still intend to roll out the tax cuts in July, but that was subject to cabinet discussions. She could not give a cast iron guarantee it would happen. We have three budgets to deliver on our commitments. We will not deliver on every single commitment in our first budget. All right, let's broaden things to get your take on each of you on the first 100 days, and we're beginning to just absorb more, I guess, of the scale of some of what's happened, not just the repeal necessarily, so the repeal side of things, but some of what the government is proposing to do instead. And one of the standouts is the fast tracking, the extent of power now vested in the hands of a small number of ministers over any number of situations, marine consents, resource consents, agriculture decisions, public acts, Public Works Act, etc. The bent towards a judicial approach to making these decisions has been bent very much back towards, or local government making these decisions has been very much bent back towards ministers based in Wellington. What do you make of it, Sue?
Look, I'll come on to the fast-tracking bill in a moment, but on the first 100 days, I'd say that it's quite some feat for an incoming government to infuriate both Māori and the entire police force all in the first 100 days, which they've managed to do. They've got the police force up in arms because they're seeing money's been spent on tax cuts for landlords and they can't get a decent pay increase, even though they're, you know, required to roll out this new and some would say, a new law and order strategy that just isn't going to work and will put the police in the firing line. You've got Māori completely consolidating around the country around the attacks that they've seen from this government in the first 100 days. So, you know, quite some feat to have achieved that. And they did say that in the first 100 days, their priority was going to be on cost of living. And yet we've seen nothing in the first 100-day plan that actually addresses those. And we've in fact seen some things in that 100-day plan that actually make cost of living issues worse. So, you know, I think overall on the first 100 days, they haven't done what they said they were setting out to do. And they haven't dealt with the really big issue that's in front of the country at the moment with cost of living. With the fast-tracking legislation, look, there's no surprises with any of that. That is always what incoming national governments do. They move to deregulate around assets and around the use of environmental regulation. That type of thing is not unusual and not surprising. Is it the right thing to do? I don't believe it is. And there are many people who are very upset about this because this is quite short-term cost-cutting, corner-cutting measures to things that are really, really valuable to our country, not only right now but going forward. I think one of the big issues that is left unsaid in that whole debate has been the schedule of projects that will be fast-tracked because they've had a process where people have had at least the opportunity on this bill to comment about what they think about the fast-tracking bill. But there's a whole schedule that is blank about what are the projects that this would be applied to. So the debate has been had in a vacuum of a critical piece of information. What are the projects that are going to be in Schedule 1 that are going to be fast-tracked? And the government's really just left itself open for a whole lot of intensive lobbying from everyone who wants to be included in that schedule.
Ben?
Yeah, well, I think returning to the first 100 days, I don't think it's true that nothing in the first 100 days has related to cost of living. I mean, at a bare minimum, the repeal of the Auckland Regional Fuel Tax, you know, that's very squarely focused on cost of living, whether you agree with the measure or not. I don't think the government has sat on its hands in this. Fast track, if you were thinking of one word, albeit hyphenated, to sort of sum up the first 100 days, it would probably be that. Right from the sort of, you know, rapid fire kind of blitzkrieg repeal of, you know, a vast swathe of legislation that constituted, you know, a significant part of the previous government's sort of, at least nascent sort of legacy, if they'd been allowed to get off the ground. Down to procedural aspects, you know, a lot of it went through urgency. I think a lot of that was justified in terms of, you know, straight repeals of laws that had been, you know, exhaustively debated. For minor things, I think that was pretty reasonable. I think they started to maybe kind of push the boundaries of it a little later into the 100 days in terms of bypassing process. But that kind of really move quickly and maybe break things, you know, deliberately break things set up by the previous government. But sort of, I think Christopher Luxon said, you know, in respect to the fast-track legislation itself, you know, it's disruptive. And I think that that's certainly what it's intended to do.
Disruptive's one thing, but I'm hoping they've stopped using this line quite as often, although they possibly will. This business of we got elected to, there is a parliamentary process. It is a process in place in order to prevent bad lawmaking or make bad law less bad. It is a fundamental constitutional aspect of living in a democracy like ours. And you can't just say we were elected to. You still got to go through the process. You put your program up to the scrutiny of the process. And by the way, you only got 30-something% of the vote anyway, and that's the biggest party.
That's right. Look, trying to sort of pin down a definition of a mandate, you know, in a technical sense is very difficult. I think that it's very straightforward that repealing the Three Waters, you know, the Water Services Entities legislation, you know, disclosure, I had clients who were in favour of that legislation, but, you know, repealing that legislation, there was a clear mandate. You know, all three parties campaigned on it that ended up in government, and it was a simple repeal, restoring the status quo, the previous status quo. That's, you know, that's one where I think you say, yeah, fair enough. And I think you're right, you know, in terms of, you know, introducing the fast-track legislation, then passing it the next day, some of the truncated select committee processes we've seen less defensible. But in terms of the fast-track legislation, I think it is really interesting because it draws together a bunch of threads that the different threads or preoccupations of the different ministers involved. Chris Bishop, obviously, you know, it's too hard to build things. The kind of paralysis around large projects in New Zealand through what you would call the sort of red tape of council processes in the Environment Court. Shane Jones, his sort of suspicion of judicial activism, you know, the kind of creeping role of tikanga in the Supreme Court's kind of own developing jurisprudence. So it is very much an effort to sidestep that process. And this brings problems, you know, of its own for the government. You know, we haven't actually seen a large groundswell of opposition to this bill, and I don't think you will, because I think the arguments about the difficulty building large projects, the infrastructure deficit, you know, are pretty compelling at this stage.
Okay.
What you will see, though, is once the projects start rolling out, the ministers won't be able to say, well, the Environment Court said it was okay, or this has nothing to do with us, we weren't the decision maker. It falls squarely on those ministers. And so Sue said, you know, it opens the door for lobbyists to run in, and, you know, I'm not sure whether any of my clients will apply for anything to be on the fast-track list, or whether I have clients who will be opposing anything that's on the fast-track list. But at the same time, it opens the doors to every protest group, every community group, every residents association who might be opposed to something being built in their backyard. And this opens up a lot of political risk for the government, because you then get, you know, constituency MPs who can be put under pressure, and there's nowhere that you can defer that responsibility. So they're on the fast track, and they're kind of driving without a bit of a seatbelt.
Yeah. All right. Let's have a look quickly at Labour and where it's at. It seems to be picking its battles, so that might be a positive way of looking at it, or it can still be fairly fatigued and in the recovery position. What did you make of its caucus retreat? Is there anything coming out of there that gives you a sense it's on the way to a healthy rebuild as opposed to an unhealthy one?
Well, it's quite late in the piece to be having the caucus retreat. These things are traditionally held over the summer break, and that it didn't happen was, I certainly found that quite concerning, because what you'd want is you'd want the new opposition to be getting into opposition mode really quickly. There's plenty of material to be taking the current government on about, including, you know, the overstepping of not using the proper parliamentary process for things that they may have felt they had a mandate on, but some of them they clearly didn't, like the, you know, like the smoking legislation that they've repealed as well. So, look, lots that they could have been taking the government on about. I think I would have liked to have seen them get into opposition mode much more quickly than they have been able to, and hopefully at their retreat they got themselves completely organised into attack mode and representing the interests of people who really depend on the Labour Party to come out fighting for issues like fair pay, for those things that have been taken away, and actually attacking the sort of lobbying that is clearly going on, where you see with the current government that, you know, the interests that they're serving are landlords, tobacco, oil companies, big business, the gun lobby. These are the things that really need to be attacked. So it's not before time that Labour gets its act together to be the opposition party that it needs to be.
Ben?
That might be a somewhat narrow list of the interests that the government represents across the three parties. But
they've all had action in the first 100 days.
Well, look, a lot of people have had action. You know, Auckland motorists have had action. But look, I think that the Labor might be looking over sort of counterintuitively, a bit enviously at the Greens. So the Greens have been rocked, you know, obviously by Gulruz Gardaman scandal, by James Shaw's resignation, the extremely tragic and untimely death of Fesa Collins, and just recently, Darlene Tala. At the same time, there is a sense that the Greens are ready to kind of turn a corner with Chloe Swarbrick as the new co-leader. If the Tala affair sort of drags on, it could be a problem, but, you know, they've actually been reasonably efficient at dealing with these issues in the past. In contrast, you know, poor old Chris Hipkins has Michael Wood, you know, who was an opponent of his on policy issues and who he had to sack, popping up as an elected member of the Labor Council. Now he's sort of leading the TVNZ rearguard union action. Stuart Nash can't help himself sort of getting on the phone to ZB talking about how weak Hipkins was on crime. Kitty Allen is still in the public spotlight. David Parker, I think I saw it, someone tweeted that David
Parker... Do you think
anyone's
noticing, Ben? No offence to any of these people, but... Seriously?
No, sure. Look, I don't think anyone's noticing Labor at all. I think they're well off the radar. But it certainly seems as if Chris Hipkins doesn't necessarily have clear air within his own party.
Well, what he doesn't have at the moment is rumours about leadership coups and everything else, which is where these things often head. He's got to make the running, and he's got to have a motivated shadow front bench that makes the running, which I think is kind of Sue's point. Let's just finish quickly with the Greens. I mentioned Winston Peters' State of the Nation speech before. I don't think there's too much more to explore there. There wasn't any sort of great break from typical themes, perhaps, in that confirmation of a sizeable fiscal hole. But Sue, just back to the Greens situation. It gets to a point where you start saying bad luck or bad management when you've got MPs either resigning or under the spot or suspended while there are investigations. The big question that come out of this also was how long, in both cases, how long it took for the party to say something publicly about it.
Yeah, the Greens need to learn quite a bit about political management. That's not surprising, given that they have been, you know, a smaller party for many years now, and they're now starting to, I guess, suffer some of the issues of being a party in growth mode. And they need to get on top of the political management, but it is really tough to conflate all of those things that Ben actually rehearsed before as having connection to each other, because they actually don't. The one bit of connection that the situation with Gulruz Gardaman and Darlene Tana probably does have is about assessing when is the right time to nip the issue in the bud from the Greens' perspective. But apart from that, they're quite different issues. They're going through a very, very tough time. I will say that one of the things on the political landscape with the smaller parties that's quite disturbing at the moment is watching Winston Peters and David Seymour trying to out-Trump each other. This is not going to end well for civilised society if we keep going down that route.
Thanks both very, very much. That is Sue Moroney and Ben Thomas.